I'd like to call the meeting to order. We have a quorum here. Representative Johnson, would you be willing to move the minutes from our last meeting? No. Representative Simon, will you help me with that? Thank you very much. I appreciate your... it's good that we have leadership here. Representative Simons, move the minutes. Any question in regards to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes approved. We're going to kind of move around the agenda a little bit. We're going to start out with House File 818. And Representative Hillstrom, we're going to probably go to Representative Erdahl's maybe after that. So stay tuned.
Great. Mr. Chair, we would ask that you move House File 818 to the Shelby Law Committee.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. The Chair will move House File 818 and onto Civil Law Committee. So go ahead, Representative Hillstrom, and when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 818 is regarding elder abuse. And there has been a large number of stakeholders, actually 52 agencies, entities, and organizations, 125 individuals have been involved developing this 2009 proposal. 50 to 60 individuals participated at each of the 8 stakeholder meetings. 10 subcommittees divided work on specific issues, reporting, definitions, and protections to bring recommendations to the stakeholder group. And 323 individuals across Minnesota participated in a 39-question online survey to gain broad input on issues and gaps in the Vulnerable Adult Act. Members, according to BusinessWire.com, they just posted a story on financial abuse costs elders more than $2.6 billion annually. The source is MetLife, and what they say is elder financial abuse costs older Americans more than $2.6 billion per year and is most often perpetrated by family members and caregivers. According to a new report released by MetLife Mature Marketing Institute, the report states up to 1 million older Americans may be targeted yearly, and that the related costs like health care, social services, investigations, legal fees, prosecution, lost income, and assets reach tens of millions of dollars annually. Members, a large number of stakeholders have been working on this issue, and I'd like to turn it over to them. This has been a consensus bill. I do have one amendment. This is to address the issues that Rich Neumeister brought forward. And so, member, Mr. Chair, I would request that you move the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative David.
I would move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Okay, Representative Davids, I think we have a kind of a problem. Don't we have to move it? So I'd like to move adoption of the committee report first, right?
So moved.
Okay. Any questions to that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
That's adopted. Opposed, I guess. None. Sorry. Representative Davids.
I'll move the H0818A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Thank you, sir. Any questions to that amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment adopted. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With me is Sandra Anderson, and she is going to talk to you about the items that are within this committee's jurisdiction. I believe it's section 1, 2, 5, 10, and 11 directly relate to Congress.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Why wouldn't
you? Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Sandra Anderson. I'm a retired senior vice president of Wells Fargo and was a founder and director of Wells Fargo Elder Services, which is an American Society on Aging award-winning program for innovative business practices serving elders and their families. I'm just completing my second term on the Minnesota Board on Aging and was vice chair of the board for 4 years. I'm here today through the Board on Aging and do not speak for Wells Fargo, although I certainly had wide exposure to all of these issues. It is my understanding that this hearing is concerned with the financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. I have 5 quick points about this bill. This bill amends the current definition of financial exploitation to provide a clearer definition that will improve the ability to identify, investigate, and prosecute criminal cases. It will give clarity to language that is currently outmoded and vague and often so confusing that no one can prosecute. Banking and financial institutions will be encouraged to report suspected financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. Encouraged, not mandated. Banks are currently restricted by so many sets of rules of who can talk to whom, who can have access to information, and how privacy works that they end up being part of the actual problem and not part of the solution. Section 5 establishes that county attorneys will have subpoena authority for the banking and financial records of a vulnerable adult. The bill extends the statute of limitations from 3 years to 5 years for criminal financial exploitation cases. From my perspective, it would be beneficial to be involved before all of the assets of a vulnerable adult are completely extracted. Most often, crimes of financial exploitation do not come to light until the person is destitute or dead. Getting involved early would help that. This will also align the statute with the limitation periods for crimes of theft by swindle, which this often is, theft by false representation, again often is, and corporate theft. And finally, Section 16 provides a right of action against the perpetrator for vulnerable adult victims of financial exploitation to recover damages and reasonable administrative costs. A right of action to recover. That's very important. So how prevalent is all of this, and why do I care, and why should you care? I'll tell you a very quick story about my own business practice. Shortly after founding Elder Services came the Great Northwest Wells Fargo merger, and I was given the opportunity to talk about my group in San Francisco. It was actually the opportunity to plead for our lives. I made the statement that I thought at least 50% of our clients had been financially abused. I had no actual facts to back that up. So, my new boss kind of gave me an eye roll, and I stated into the distance and said, I'll come back to you on that. When I got home, I got my staff together, which at that time was only 3 officers and 2 assistants, and I asked them to bring their customer list and make a tick mark like everybody they knew had been financially abused. That number was 76%. 76% of my clients had been financially abused. As a citizen of this state, I'm just disgusted that our laws even allow that. But what's the acceptable number? 50%? 36%? I don't know.
Okay. Go ahead. Keep going. He'll ask when you're done. Okay.
As public policy, or the lack thereof, this is just important to me. As individuals, all of you who are the elected representatives of elders, the daughters, sons, nieces, nephews, and friends of elders, who may be elders now, or God willing, will be elders sometime, look into your own hearts and follow your own values. That's why you're elected. I thank you very much for your time today. Please call the Board on Aging for any additional information. Part of their charge is to be advisory to you, the legislators. Please use them. They know amazing things. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Representative David, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is my first, I've got a couple. My first question may be to Mr. Pender. Mr. Pender, on page 3, we add or vulnerable adults. How is vulnerable adults defined in statute?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, I would have to look it up. I don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, and to the witness, I've got an answer to your question on what number is acceptable for people having problems with this situation. The answer is zero.
Thank you.
The answer is zero. And I'm just wondering if anybody in the crowd wants to testify on behalf of financial exploitation of vulnerable adults or where we're at there. But I guess one question that I would have is, in real life, I'm in the financial business, and you're working with somebody. I've been in 27 years, and you might start working with them when they're not vulnerable. That's why I want to know what the definition is. Maybe you have that. And then 10 years later, they start to develop dementia, Alzheimer's, things like that, and you're trying to keep everything in. But what determines when they're vulnerable and when they're not? So you know, and then you start getting all their records, and the financial professional's names on the stuff and was doing it right while they were making sound decisions, and now they're having troubles with decisions. Where is the line there?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a whole group of experts with me that can probably help with what the definition is. So if you want to come to the table, you can pull up a chair, and we can maybe expedite some of these.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm just the mouthpiece for this. The group really did put this together, and it is a consensus bill, and so we may as well use the experts that work on this.
Thank you, sir. Please state your name for the record, and go ahead and answer Representative David's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative David, the definition for vulnerable adult is found within the Vulnerable Adult Act, which is 626.5572, subdivision 21. And essentially, a vulnerable adult has two parts. It's either based upon the services they receive, which means they are a categorical vulnerable adult, or based upon mental or physical frailty, in which they are a functional vulnerable adult.
Sir, please state your name again for the record.
Kevin Hansen with Elder Care Rights Alliance.
Thank you, sir. Representative David?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to know if there's anybody that wants to testify on the opposite side, if there's any opposition to this bill, seriously.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Up to this point, the only person that had come forward with concerns in committee was Rick Neumeister, and we fixed his concern with the amendment.
You fixed him, huh?
Well, let's ask and see. Anybody out in the audience like to be heard for or against this bill? I don't see a mad rush. So any questions up here for regards to this bill? Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, can you give an example of the third-party portion in Section 5?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, and Representative Anderson. The language that's titled in the name of the vulnerable adult or a third party, that specifically refers to joint accounts, which often are titled jointly, as in the vulnerable adult and maybe perhaps the power of attorney, if there is one. Also, that applies to trusts as well. If a trust has been created for the benefit of the vulnerable adult, it is not titled in their name, although the funds may be for the benefit, the vulnerable adult will be the beneficiary of said trust. So we worked with the banking institutions and their representatives, and that was some language they suggested to make sure we fully address that.
Representative Anderson, anything further? Any further questions up here? Seeing none, any final comments, Representative Hillstrom?
Please vote yes.
Please. Please is always good. With that, Representative Davis, like, to renew your motion or do?
Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 818 as amended be recommended passed and sent to the Committee on
Civil Law and Civil Justice or something. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hillstrom, any comments about this morning?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, thank you very much. House File 908 is. Do we not?
We're waiting for an amendment to pass, so let's take the next one.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Junkie, are you present and accounted for? We're not doing so well there.
It won't take long until we hear about this.
Do we have a Representative Hoppy's bill or something?
Don't have one, but I think it's pretty simple. Junkies, if we want to.
What is your bill?
I'm a co-author in Junkies Bill.
Do you want
to? If we have any opposition to it.
Do you want to present it, or you can do it there if you like, or?
Done. It's so bipartisan.
A lot of teamwork today. It must have been those great bars that we got from our staff.
Those were outstanding.
Representative Hoppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I would move House File 1149, and there is an amendment. I think everybody has in their packets because I had it. It's Representative Junkie's bill. I'm a co-author on it, and I don't think that there's any controversy or questions or comments from the audience, and I know we have some telecom people here if we do have questions or comments. Okay.
Representative Hoppy, I believe we need to move adoption of the committee report.
Okay.
To start. So, any questions in regards to the committee report? Seeing none, all in favor of the committee report, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Committee report adopted. Go ahead, Representative Hoppy. Sorry.
I'd like to move the A2 amendment to the House File 1149.
Representative Hoppy has moved the A2 amendment. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? A2 is adopted, sir. Any other amendments, or we're
I think that's it. I think it's relatively simple and straightforward, and stand for any questions.
Anybody in the audience?
Let's vote quick.
Anybody in the audience that would like to be heard for or against this bill? Seeing none. With that, Representative, any questions up here, rather? Seeing none. Representative Hoppe, would you like to renew your motion?
I would like to renew my motion, Mr. Chair, that House File 1149 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
General Register, sir.
That's it.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? It passed. Thank you, Representative Hoppe. That's a very good sign of teamwork. Maybe that'll be just like that right till the end of session.
In the valley.
Representative Erdahl. You must have been concerned about Representative Knuth's vote. I see you're wearing orange today.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House File 908. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the committee report on House File 908.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Any questions to Representative Zellers' motion? We need to vote on the committee report. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Committee report adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 908 be passed and sent to the Finance Committee.
With that, we have your bill before us, sir, and Representative Erdahl, do you have some amendments?
We need to do a couple of amendments here.
Yeah, I just,
you are receiving, as we speak, the A090164. That's my delete-all amendment. I need to incorporate into it also the H0908A2 amendment. So you have two amendments coming to you.
Okay. Should we
incorporate the smaller one into the delete all?
Does everybody have the amendments before them, at least? We'll start there. I don't believe they're all handed out. Representative Erdahl, why don't you go ahead and start, and then we'll kind of go into the amendments a little bit later.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Again, thank you. Appreciate your indulgence here. The this bill deals with the shared workers program. The language that you are now receiving is the language that has been recommended by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. In 1944, the shared workers program was modeled after federal language, and this is supposed to help workers. The shared workers program allows workers to share hours or days with other workers, thus allowing an employer who might otherwise be forced to lay off workers to keep more employed at fewer hours and with benefits. The program is through deed and it's for 1 year. A 6-month hiatus from the program is mandatory once the year is completed. In prosperous economic times, this works, but in a recession, it leads to layoffs. And House File 908, as amended, will drop this 6-month hiatus provision, keeping workers employed with benefits. And it basically, the change, the delete-all, makes it a 2-year program with a revision able to be done by the commissioner. I have with me Mr. Steve Michael, who is a executive with the Dura Supreme Company in Howard Lake, and would speak to the program.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Sure. My name is Steve Michael, and I work for Dura Supreme Cabinetry in Howard Lake, Minnesota, which is in Wright County. I work for the owner of the business. The business is a semi-custom residential cabinetry manufacturer. We distribute nationally. We have roughly 550 employees right now. This is a private business, so we don't publish our revenues, but they're between $50 and $100 million. We support Representative Erdahl's amendment. We just completed 1 year in the program. And essentially, What this program allowed us to do is to have our business overstaffed by 50 to 100 people throughout the course of the year that we were in the program. We're able to cut 20% of our hours out and yet keep everybody working and have them available for health insurance and other benefit programs. And as Representative Erdahl said, we feel that this program works very well during normal recessions, but I think what we have on our hands right now is something other than that, and so we're looking to change that six-month hiatus out of the program. I've provided a summary page dated March 13th. Perhaps that's been passed around as well, and I'm able to take any questions that you have concerning the program and how it works for our business.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Representative Erdahl, I believe we're kind of ready to take a swing at your bill. Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the DE-1 amendment.
Representative Zellers has moved the DE-1 amendment. Any questions in regards to that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? DE-1 adopted.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I would I'd like to incorporate the A-2 amendment into the DE-1.
Okay. So that's, I don't think we have to vote.
Okay.
Do I have to adopt that or vote? Let's just vote on it.
Yeah.
All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? So moved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have the DE-1 as amended and the form of the author and pretty much everybody else up here would like. Appreciate your indulgence.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. And any further questions? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Hoppe, please do not ask me to explain that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, one short question. Is anybody opposed to this?
Representative Erdahl.
No one, thank you, Mr. Chairman. No one that I've heard of.
Thank you.
Going back to Representative Zeller's second, so that's the second, the A2, adoption of the A2. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? A2 is adopted to the DE-1 as amended. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'll renew my motion to approve House File 908 as amended, be passed and moved to the Finance Committee.
Representative Zellers renews his motion. Seeing no questions, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill is on the way, sir.
Thank you very much.
House File 357, Representative Fulton.
Representative Falk, welcome back. House File 357 came to us from the Energy Committee. There is an author's amendment. We'll first move the bill. We're going to put the amendment on, then we're eventually going to lay the bill over. We got the amendment a little bit later than we normally like, but I'll visit about that here shortly. Chair will move House File 357. Be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Energy. First off, to put it in the shape that the author would like to proceed with it, we've got the A8 author's amendment. It's my understanding that that's in everyone's packet, that the chair will move the A8 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails anyway. Thank you very much. As members know, we're the only committee in the House without any rules. We're quite proud of that. Which means we don't have a 24-hour rule for amendments, and we don't have all of the various things that other committees do have, but we do have one rule, we've got two, the golden rule, which is we all do what the chair wants, and the silver rule, which is equally important, and that is that we try to treat everybody fairly. And the amendment, we accepted, we placed on the bill. It's my understanding that that is an amendment that some folks like quite a bit and makes the bill a little bit more palatable to some folks. But the fact is we just got it a couple hours ago.
And I didn't want to send, we've got some testifiers here today, I didn't want to send them back home just to come back again on Tuesday. So what I want to do is take all of the testimony today to the bill as amended, because that's, I think, the shape in which it's going to move forward. Make sure that we give members an opportunity to ask some questions. We will then lay the bill over, and we will actually take a vote on it on Tuesday. And that'll give anybody that just saw the amendment recently, whether it's in the minority or in the industry or members on either side of the aisle, an opportunity to take a look at the amendment, take a look at the bill, think about it, digest it, and we'll vote on Tuesday. With that, we do have a number of bills yet coming, so what I'd like to do, if possible, is to have the proponents and opponents kind of try to each side maybe about 15 minutes, give or take, hopefully that'll be enough so we got a good picture of what's going on and we've got a good sense of the bill and we can then lay the bill over at that time and take up some other bills. Representative Falk, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to bring House File 357 to your attention. And I do apologize for the amendment arriving kind of late, but we've been working with stakeholders trying to figure out a means to find some real common ground. This is an issue that we feel needs to be addressed, and there's good language here. A brief overview about this bill. It deals with CBET, otherwise known as Community-Based Energy Development. And as our state has put forward a very aggressive renewable energy policy and some incentives to transition to forms of what we call green energy, we wanted to put in place the mechanisms to encourage local communities to participate, to get local business owners, local farmers, local school districts, forms of local entities involved in owning these new renewable energy resources. I personally feel it's one of the best mechanisms we have to reinvest in our rural parts of the state, to rebuild some of our rural communities. This is the next frontier in what we can do. We really believe that green energy, whether it's in the biofuels or other forms of renewable energy such as biomass, wind, solar, are a way that we can bring jobs and opportunities back out to rural parts of the state. And so we're trying to work to find ways to help facilitate that development of renewable energy. And the concept of CBET is putting in place some mechanisms to help that take place. What this bill does is it deals with contract issues. Specifically, we've seen a large amount of wind projects being developed. And the problem is we might try to come to an agreement on when a utility has a request for proposals and a proponent or people who are responding to that. Oftentimes, negotiations to settle in on the contract take far and away too long. And so we see that the market changes are the dynamics. We've seen increases in turbine prices. We've seen increases in price of electricity. And so in the course of trying to negotiate these contracts, so much of the environment has changed that the contract, it isn't workable. So what we're trying to do is to figure out a means to develop a standardized contract for both projects that are small and a little bit larger, and as a way to basically allow these things to move forward in a more timely manner. I have a number of esteemed testifiers which I'd like to bring up. I don't want to take too much of the time tooting my own horn about the merits of this, but I'd really like to give them the chance to speak to what is required, what is needed. And I would also like to express, too, that we have worked extensively with people to try to find some compromise language. There were some issues people had contention with. We try to alleviate as much of those issues as possible. And one particular area is in the author's amendment, looking at Subdivision 5. We're really trying to leverage, there's a talk of a need to get 200 megawatts, but we're requiring that to be tied to some type of incentive program. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, that's a federal program, stimulus package. We want to go and facilitate and encourage projects where we can leverage some of the federal monies. Additionally, there's the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Energy for America program. We want to make sure that projects which are eligible, that can be built, that can be in the ground before December 31st, 2010, have the ability to move forward. I think this is one of the things that we can all agree on, that if there's projects that are ready to be built, that are eligible for federal money, we should work to make sure that they are being developed and we are getting those jobs and that investment made in our communities. And with that, I would like to bring up my first testifier, the esteemed General Leslie Clark.
Thank you, Representative Falk. General Clark, welcome to the committee.
For Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wes Clark, and I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas, and I'm up here to testify on behalf of this bill, House File Number 357. I think it's an important piece of legislation for Minnesota. It's important for the country. This is a bill that has to do with American energy independence. It has to do with our response to the challenge of climate change, and perhaps most importantly, it has to do with economics in Minnesota. This bill is about jobs and immediate jobs. There is an urgency to this bill because the stimulus package that was passed in mid-December, which is called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, offers the greatest incentives for projects that are underway or in construction phase by the 31st of December of 2010. Now, in the wind energy business, one of the problems you have is just the mechanics. You know there's wind there, but how do you get the paperwork done? How do you get the rate negotiated? How do you get the contract done? And what this bill does is it simplifies those two important aspects of the economic program, so it lets small wind development projects, 5 megawatts and below, that are already, we know where the wind is, we know where the wind turbines are, it's just a matter of going out there and organizing it. It lets us move quickly through those projects. And there are dozens of sites around Minnesota where these projects could take place. Think of it this way. Every megawatt of wind is a $2 million construction project. And what this bill is authorizing is about $400 million worth of construction, the 200 megawatt provision in here, to try to get in the ground before the end of December next year. And that's jobs for Minnesota, that's reduced carbon emissions for the United States and mankind, and that's a step toward energy independence, and that's good for national security. So I strongly encourage the committee to look favorably upon this proposed legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, General, and I appreciate your testimony, and I think on behalf of the committee, we all appreciate your service as well. Thank you. Mr. Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Tough act to follow, ain't it?
Yes, it is, yeah. But they wouldn't let me go first.
If you just identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Bob Olson. I am the majority owner and chairman of St. Stephen State Bank in St. Cloud. And in addition to being a boring banker, I'm a boring tax lawyer. So if you have questions on that side of things, I may have some answers for you. I'm also a member of the Independent Community Bankers Association of Minnesota. Our representative, Dave Gilbred, is here with us. We endorse this bill, the passage of this bill. Right now, as it stands, members of Minnesota's communities and the banks of Minnesota are left out of the wind energy business. A friend of mine wrote a paper entitled, Who Shall Own the Wind? And he asked the question, will Minnesota do like what happened under Abraham Lincoln's Homestead Act, where the people who lived on the land, worked the land, owned the land? Or will Minnesota do like it did with its timber industry and its mining industry, where we sell it off at nickels on the dollar, and the people of Minnesota work for minimum wage or less? Right now, we are doing the latter. And it's because of legislation. You people in this room have the power to change it. Legislation as it exists now does not allow community banks or members of Minnesota's rural communities or people who are not very, very wealthy to own wind resources. These wind turbines out there produce $250,000 to $400,000 of cash flow per year. Farmers feel good about getting $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 of that. I was down in Dexter, Minnesota, in a restaurant. The waitress said, well, business is good. They're building us 100 windmills there. But once the construction workers are gone, the community is going to almost not benefit whatsoever. That money is going out of the state and in many, many cases going out of the country. Now, one criticism of this bill that I've heard is that this would increase the cost of the electricity because of the tariff, as it's called. Now, I looked at that. I think a good high school mathematics student would tell you that that's not the case. We're talking about present values here. Definitely community banks think that this would be good for Minnesota. Right now, it's only the Wall Street banks that are participating in these large projects.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. And General, thank you. I think what we'll do is we'll take the balance of the testimony, and then we'll see if members have any questions or concerns for any of the testifiers. So thank you, gentlemen, very much. I've got three or four people on the list in addition. Deborah Bergen, Glenn Skabarka, Beth Soholt, and Kenrick Shavel. In what order you arrive, you're welcome to testify. Welcome to the committee. And if you just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, and give or take, we're trying to fit it within about 15, 20 minutes if you can.
Yes, sir.
Thank you,
Representative Atkins, member of the committee. My name is Deborah Bergen. I'm with Missouri River Energy Services. We're a municipal power agency. Our headquarters are located in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. However, we are a municipal power supplier to 60 municipal electric communities in the states of North and South Dakota, Iowa, and Minnesota. We are also a member of Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, which Mr. Bill Blackshear next to me is with. I'll let him introduce himself. And actually, Mr. Black will testify on behalf of not only MRES, but the municipal community as a whole.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Black. I'm with the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I wasn't planning to testify, but I do work with...
Thank you very much, then, and we'll move on.
But since I'm already here...
I'm sorry, Mr. Black. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, I represent the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, which is 125 municipal utilities in the state, the electric and 30 gas utilities. We also have as our members... as members of our association, the six municipal power agencies that serve those municipal utilities. And the reason that I've come up is after seeing the amendment here, it caused some confusion, and we were trying to work out exactly the effect of the amendment, and I think we're still not quite clear on it, and we wanted to make sure that the committee members weren't as confused as we were. At the in line 1.8 and in other places in the bill for the amendment, you'll see that it seems to waive the requirements for the municipal and cooperative utilities. We don't represent the cooperative, but we're treated the same way in the statute. The line just above says section 216B 16.91, and that's the renewable energy standard. The renewable energy standard sets requirements on municipal power agencies that serve municipal utilities, and generation and transmission cooperatives that serve cooperative electric associations. So if the intent of the amendment is to exempt cooperative and municipal utilities, I'm not sure that this does that. I think that the language would have to refer to the entities that have an IES requirement, which would be the power agencies and the GNPs. So, and the power districts, there's one power district that is similar to a municipal power agency. So we wanted to make sure that we weren't going under the assumption that this would not affect cooperatives and municipals, because as we read it and discussed it, we believe that it would.
Thank you, Mr. Black. That's one of the reasons that why when we have a rather late amendment. We welcome amendments to try to shape things up, but at the same time, it's also good to lay a bill over so we have an opportunity to make sure that we get the language just the way we want it. Does that conclude both of your... There was kind of a phone a friend there, and okay, I just wanted to make sure. Then I've got, in addition, we've got Mr. Skabarka, and I'm sure I've just tortured your poor last name there, sir, but...
Finnish names are just pronounced as they're...
We love Finnish names. They're just... If you'll identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
As Chairman, members, I'm Glenn Skabarka. I manage resource planning for Great River Energy. Great River Energy is a generation and transmission cooperative We source about a sixth of the electric energy used in the state of Minnesota. As with the previous testifiers, we have not seen the amendment for any great length of time, and we too have some confusion about its applicability to cooperatives and to our cooperative in particular. For example, in line 1.8, the word cooperative association is used. In lines 1.18 and 2.19, the words cooperative electric association are used. I don't know if that distinction is intentional or not, and I don't know if its effect on us. So with that handicap, I'm just going to limit my testimony here today to the rate itself. And your testimony earlier that this rate is would not be a higher rate. As we understand the way it would work, that simply is not true. What the rate formula does for small wind projects in this bill is it's comparing a present value of future prices to a current spot market price. And if you do the math on it, that ends up operating as a subsidy for wind projects that would be eligible for that rate. As we've worked through the math looking at this before, that the amount of this subsidy looks to be about 50% above the wind proposals that we are currently seeing. So the result of that is that it would raise the cost of complying with renewable energy standards for Great River Energy. It's a little hard to tell by how much, because the amount that we would be obligated to take is also not real clear to us, at least in the quick reading of the amended bill. But if it were to be GRE taking about a sixth of the amount of the small wind at the rate specified in the bill, it would raise our compliance costs on the order of $4 million per year. The only other thing I guess I'll say about it is that we see no shortage of wind proposals. We've seen no shortage of seabed proposals either. We welcome seabed proposals. We'll welcome them in the future. We have not seen rates being barriers to making seabed happen. And I guess we have some concerns about putting a subsidy in, obligating ourselves to a subsidy that would raise our compliance costs with the RES.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Beth Soholt, S-O-H-O-L-T. I'm Director for Wind on the Wires. Wind on the Wires is a program of the Isaac Walton League of America and is a collaboration between environmental organizations in the Midwest and the wind industry. Our board is split roughly 50-50 between those two classes of members. And although Wind on the Wires works to promote wind development generally, we're really agnostic as far as ownership models. What we're trying to do is bring wind energy to market, regardless of who owns it. And we've been a long supporter of community wind. I should point out that we have several companies that are community-based energy developers that are members of Wind on the Wires. And we have worked with the seabed statute and with renewables and transmission issues for quite a number of years. And we really do want community-based energy development to succeed, but on a level playing field. We want it to have a fair shot in the marketplace, but not at the expense of something else. So I think Representative Foss has made some significant modifications to his original bill, but my testimony here is really tailored to the prior bill, since we really saw this amendment about an hour ago. But I think he is serious about wanting to address issues, and we really do appreciate that. But we still do have some significant concerns about the bill, and I think cannot recommend that you pass this legislation today. There needs to be some additional work done. I think even though the 800 megawatts has been brought down in the amendment to 200 megawatts, it's still not clear which utilities would be required to purchase, if these seabed megawatts would need to be installed before any other types of renewable energy projects that would fulfill the renewable energy standard. And as a result, our primary concern is that We have a big renewable energy standard in legislation for the utilities to meet, and we really need to allow that the utilities to work on that and not change it every year. It makes compliance with the REF too difficult. There are concerns that folks have raised about the constitutionality of the proposed seabed mandate due to the impacts on interstate commerce. I think that those issues are not totally done away with in the amendment, as well as a PURPA issue, a federal law, the Public Utility Regulatory Procedure Act of 1978, preempts the state from setting costs for renewable power above a utility's avoided cost. If this were put in place, these issues would have to be litigated, adding additional time to the state complying with renewable energy standards. And so that continues to be a concern. The definitions of CBED, the community-based energy development, is something that we have worked on with other parties probably 4 out of the last 4 legislative sessions. We have struggled with finding a definition that would work for multiple types of CBED developers, and I don't believe that we're quite there yet. And so changing the statute just for the sake of changing it again this year, when we still don't have a definition that works for a lot of folks to be able to spread the wealth in doing these projects, I don't believe is something that the legislature should do. And finally, the Minnesota RES does contain pretty significant off-ramp for the utilities to get out of complying with the significant renewable energy standard. And they really give the Public Utilities Commission the authority to reduce or delay a utility's RES obligation in the event that implementation of the RES would cause too great a cost burden on the utility's ratepayers. The off-ramps are intended to be a last resort, but as Mr. Starbaca just testified, if the rate impacts were truly 50%, that could cause an extreme rate impact on the utility ratepayers, and the utilities could seek to use the off-ramp. I don't think that's what the legislature intended when they passed the renewable energy standard. I think they intended it to be something that the utilities would be able to comply with. That's kind of the bad news. Let me switch to the good news for a minute here and just address...
And you're just about out of time, of course. So... Okay. I'm not going to cut you off, but there's about a minute and a half left for Mr. Shavel, and then I also have Mr. Evans.
Okay, I will conclude quickly.
Thank you.
I just wanted to point out that in 2008, fully a quarter of the new megawatts of wind that were done in Minnesota were defined as community-based energy development. Now, some people could say, well, it should be 100%, it should be 80% or 75% or whatever the number might be, but the point is that the utilities are figuring out how to do seabed. They needed a couple years to figure out how to do it. They're signing power purchase agreements. They have a lot that they've people have bid into them that they're reviewing and will be signing up more. And so by our account, what we have in law is currently working. So with that point, I'll leave it there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And is it Scavel, by the way? Mr. Scavel.
That's the chairman. It is.
Former senator.
That is correct.
Welcome back.
Well, it was a pleasure to testify.
Well, that's arguable, but we appreciate the... I'm sorry to have butchered your name earlier, but welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kenrick Scavel. I'm a government relations representative for Dairyland Power Cooperative, which is headquartered in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Dairyland provides wholesale electricity to 25 distribution cooperatives in 4 states, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. 3 of those cooperatives are located in southeastern Minnesota and are respectively located in Rushford, in Rochester, and in Albert Lea. I'd like to focus my remarks fairly briefly on House File 357, less on the concept of seabed and more on the concept of what's generally referred to as feed-in tariff or alternative renewable tariff language. For those of you that aren't familiar with those terminologies, essentially it refers to setting in statute a prescribed rate that must be paid for the purchase of renewable energy, typically set at a rate that guarantees a profit margin on the investment. So that's the concept. And what I'd like to do is hand out something that was prepared from the Iowa lead attorney for the Iowa Utilities Board. I know some of the members have already seen this language, but essentially this concept is being discussed in numerous states. It's being discussed in, I think, all of the states that Dairyland serves, such as Wisconsin and Illinois and Iowa. Mr. Lynch, the attorney, did a little research based on this kind of proposal being brought forth in the Iowa legislature. And what he researched was the Public Utilities Regulatory Policy Act of 1978, which originally established the standards to encourage renewable energy generation. And what they essentially did was they said that utilities must purchase renewable energy from qualifying renewable energy resources at avoided cost. Now, there was some controversy as to whether or not that preempted states from requiring reimbursement levels or tariffs higher than avoided cost. And it's actually gone back and forth through the years. But the most current decision or rendering, if you will, by the Federal Energy Regulatory Policy Act, or excuse me, by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, essentially stated that federal law preempts the states from requiring utilities to purchase renewable energy at rates above avoided cost. Therefore, I can only assume that if this language was put into statute, it would be susceptible to challenge in the courts and FERC ruling. Now, Mr. Lynch went further to say this especially applies to cooperatives and municipalities because they are not rate-regulated entities. And indeed, he went one step farther and said that in the case of cooperatives and utilities, because they're non-rate-regulated entities, he questions whether the states have any authority to prescribe rates that they must pay for renewable energy, even if it was at or less than their avoided cost. I'm trying to condense my comments because of your time constraints, but in essence, I guess what I would put to the committee is I think that this legislation is at risk of being in conflict with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's declaration that PURPA preempts state laws requiring an electric utility to purchase power at a rate higher than avoided cost. And, Mr. Chair, if I could add one more personal comment. I think this would be precedent-setting legislation that would go far beyond the utility industry. Because once the state legislature deems it appropriate to set in statute the price a business must pay for a commodity, you have to ask, where does the line become drawn? Do you then say, we don't like Walmart purchasing products from overseas, so let's require them to purchase from any given distributor at whatever it takes to make them profitable?
Mr. Scavo, you know Representative Kahn is in the room. You're giving her ideas right now. Unfortunately, she's taken with another issue right now, but you might want to...
Well, Mr. Chair, I just had to add that as a personal note from a policy standpoint, over and above the federal preemption.
We appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Scavo. And Mr. Evans, welcome back. Although I don't know if you've been in this committee. I'm on energy, too, so I see you all the time.
I think
launch right out. That's our ejector seat there, Scavo. Anybody goes over my time limits, we just shoot them right out. Mr. Evans, I know you can be right to the point.
I will try, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Evans. I'm with Xcel Energy, and with the, by my calculation, negative 2.5 minutes that I have to talk with you, let me just go over a couple of quick facts. First of all, I want to make clear that Xcel Energy is a supporter of community-based energy development. We have 80 megawatts of community-based energy currently in that's being produced. We have another 40 megawatts under contract. We recently opened responses to an RFP for exclusively seabed energy. We had 2,200 megawatts of seabed energy proposed to us. And under state law, we're required to file a renewable energy plan, which we have filed with the PUC, in which we've committed to acquire approximately one-third of our renewable energy standard as seabed energy. That would amount to about 1,300 megawatts of seabed energy in total. So we are a supporter of seabed, but we're not a supporter of this bill. Let me try to put a dollar figure. I think we've put our best accountant, that's not me, to work on this. By our calculations under this bill, we would be required to pay $93.43 per megawatt hour for seabed energy that we purchased under this bill. We have currently got a seabed project of 4.5 megawatts, so it would qualify under this bill, that is currently under construction. That poor fellow negotiated a price with us, an arm's-length negotiation across the table, of $65 per megawatt hour. So the next guy who builds that identical project will get $93 a megawatt hour. This guy's getting $65 a megawatt hour. To put that in context, for each year that it is in production, that is over $300,000 of additional money going to the seabed developer who has the good fortune to build his project under this bill. $300,000 per year for a 20-year contract coming from our ratepayers. And I'm not going to focus on the ratepayers. I'd like to focus just for a moment on who it is that's getting that money, because we're proud of the people that are doing these seabed contracts, but I think we have seen in spades over the last few weeks from the federal government that when the state or the government confers that kind of a benefit on private business, they ought to be very careful about where that money's going and who's getting that benefit. Otherwise, things can go tragically wrong. Under the current seabed statutes, there is absolutely no requirement that the owner of a seabed project live anywhere close to the community where it's built. A millionaire sitting on the shores of Lake Minnetonka could build a 5-megawatt seabed project in Luverne, Minnesota, and never set foot in the town. And the only guy in Luverne who's going to see a penny of it is the farmer who rents in his land. And the guy would sit on the shores of Lake Minnetonka and collect $300,000 per year more than the guy who's negotiated an arm's-length transaction with us for 4.5 megawatts. That's a real problem with this bill. We're not, because of the way the seabed statute is structured, we are not guaranteeing community-based energy development. We are guaranteeing Minnesotans who have good money and good credit, who can afford to go out and put these things up, they're going to get a tremendous benefit. But whether the community shares or not is not something that this statute requires. The other problem that we have is that the way these things work is that a seabed developer goes in and presents a pro forma to the Office of Energy Security and says, this is how we're going to divide up the money on our project. And the Office of Energy Security says, yes, that looks like a seabed project to us. Go forth and do good. That is the first and last time that anyone in the state government ever looks at how that project is structured. If the contracts are put together consistent with the pro forma, there's nobody in the state who knows that. If the contracts are actually executed consistent with the pro forma, there's nobody in the state who knows that. And just to go back to my example of the fellow sitting on Lake Minnetonka, if 10 years into his contract he retires and moves to Arizona, he will collect the exact same amount of money, and there's nobody in the state who will know that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. You just described my dream life, I think, Mr. Evans. At least in the wintertime. With that, and are you coming down to testify on this? Is that Mr. Sokolowski or Sokolowski? All right. You're going to be our last testifier. We're going to come back on Tuesday and take some questions and concerns that people have. I'm glad that we decided to do what we did, which is to lay the bill over so that we'd have an opportunity for people to digest that amendment. Mr. Sokolowski.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, staff and committee members. My name is Adam Sokolowski. I work for a company called Iberdrola Renewables. We're a large wind power development company. We own 400 megawatts of wind power facilities here in Minnesota, pay about $1.6 million in tax in production taxes every year. We've got some serious concerns with the bill. Most of our concerns are consistent with wind on the wires concerns, but primarily two or three. First of all, we're concerned about the bill's premium cost for these projects to impact the renewable energy standard. We have a very aggressive renewable energy standard in Minnesota. It's one of the reasons why Minnesota is so rich with wind developments and wind development interests. We're concerned that those higher costs will indeed trigger the off-ramp that we spoke of before and either delay compliance with the renewable energy standards or allow some utilities an opt-out or an off-ramp to that renewable energy standard. That really equates to a slower transition for our state to renewable energy. Secondly, and it might not be as bad in the current edition of the bill. I only saw it about an hour ago, and we need to do some more analysis on it. But the bill appears to close out the wind development market to companies like ours, Iberdrola, and others for at least the next couple of years.
Cool.
The 200 megawatt must-buy provision, while maybe softened in the current author's amendment, to us looks like words that say, look, you can't bid into Minnesota in the next 2 years. You can't sell your energy to a Minnesota utility for the next couple of years. There's some gray areas in new language, but it really makes us nervous and concerned about that aspect. We have two projects in very late-term development right now. They're worth about $600 million in capital costs that we'd like to build, maybe not in the next 2 years, but certainly one of those in the next 2 years. And that certainly makes our company nervous that we won't be able to even bid those projects into a request for proposals. Finally, I think Representative Falk has some good ideas with respect to the standard contract language that's found in the bill. Clearly, for small projects, negotiating out long contracts is a concern. And it's something that I'd be very happy to work with him and the proponents of the bill on. It's certainly that's an area that we think could probably go forward with a little bit of extra work. So my last thought is transmission in Minnesota is a big issue for all projects of just about every size, and we'd like to see some more focus on that as well. Thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Sikalski. And we've got three bills left, folks, so we're going to lay the bill over at this time. I apologize to the extent that people had questions right now.
Mr. Chair, could I ask?
Excellent. I one person.
Representative Chairman, I'd like to, if we're going to get into question and answer, we've got a lot of questions on our side.
I kind of gathered that. You guys were jotting things down for notes, and I appreciate that. That's new for you, Representative David.
Well,
but we've
we've already checked our brackets, Mr. Chair.
We
so
just decided to put it entirely on your bill, Representative David. It's actually in the amendment that we finally got passed out. So Representative Falk, I'll give you the final word, then we're going to lay the bill over.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say that I had one more person in the audience who wished to testify who had come in a ways, but if it's not possible, it's understandable. So.
Actually, we can't because we have to get out of this room.
Understandable.
If we weren't getting booted from the room here shortly. And we will take questions to the extent that members have them, so there will be an opportunity for additional testimony possibly in order to answer those questions. With that, we lay over House File 357. Thank you, Representative David. Thank you, everyone that came in to testify with respect to the bill. Representative Nelson's bill is House File. I'll find it here soon. 1418. The chair will actually, Representative Dabney will move the committee report with respect to House File 1418. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, seeing none, that motion does prevail. Now, Representative Nelson will move that House File 1418 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. Representative Nelson, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. And what this bill is about, last year, Representative Mahoney spent a lot of time, I think through nine delete all amendments, setting up the electrical for the plumbing board. And it was modeled after the electrical board. One of the things through all the changes that were going on through all of his delete all amendments was that there was a slight oversight that they, the part dealing with continuing education. And what this bill does is basically put the continuing education underneath the purview of the new plumbing board, and similar to what the electrical board is. And that's what it does.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Sounds terribly controversial. Is there anyone here in opposition to this? Seeing none, are there questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I'm just curious. Wouldn't this be considered really a conflict of interest since the plumbing board is made up of plumbers and they'd be the ones deciding what they're...
And the lawyers board is made up of lawyers. But Representative Nelson.
Like I said, the setup of the board is like the electrical board, and the electrical board is set up the same way. The people on the electrical board are the ones that oversee the continuing education. Part of the reason for that is the electricians, or the plumbers in this case that are doing the work in the field, they can see what they need to do for continuing education, what they need to study, what they need to progress, and they're the ones that make those suggestions, and that's why it's that way.
Thank you. Any other questions or concerns? If not, Representative Daniel will renew his motion to House File 1418. We recommend pass and refer to the Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? seeing one, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Do we have Representative Ross?
Thank you, Committee, and thank you, Representative David.
If not, we'll move to my bill.
Chair Atkins, are you moving House File
1619? Be reckoned pass and referred to wherever it can go.
To the General Register.
General Register. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. We go ahead when you're ready, sir.
It's very simple. It makes a small update that I believe everybody's in agreement on, that updates Minnesota No Fault Statute. The funeral benefit from $2,000 up to $5,000. It's my understanding that the industry representatives are in support of it. Change hasn't been made for something going on 20 years, give or take, just kind of updates to recognize that funeral benefits cost a little bit more than they used to.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Testifiers, are we...
There's a couple folks in the audience here that I think are here to say they are okay with the bill, but...
Okay. Should we...
And they'll be very brief, I believe.
Please say your name and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Chair members, thank you. I will be brief. I'm Elaine Love, Government Affairs Representative with Farmers Insurance, speaking on behalf of my employer. Briefly, I will say that we support, in general, no-fault reform. We support the increase in funeral benefits in this bill, and we look forward to working with Representative Atkins to perhaps enhance benefits, save some money for our consumers so we can do some cost-saving measures. Some of the measures that are in the current bill moving in the Senate are good, and our no-fault team has some additional ideas, too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Rizzolo, and I'm a Government Affairs Counsel with American Family Insurance. I'll be even more brief what she said. We also support Representative Atkins' bill and look forward to working on additional no-fault reform.
Thank you very much. Anybody? Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chair, is this where I make the motion to repeal the no-fault statute, or should I wait for the floor to do that, or...
Well, you can do it in both places if you like, sir.
I'll wait for the floor, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, though, in deference to the time.
Probably a good call. Anybody in the audience like to be heard for or against this bill? Seeing none, no questions up here. With that, Chair Atkins renews his motion.
I'll renew my motion that House File 1619 we recommend pass and refer to the General Register.
Seeing no comment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Seeing none, your bill is passed. Chair Atkins, Representative Loffer, I don't see.
I got a plan. Gophers game starts in 12 minutes. I'll move. Representative Loffer's bill, House File 705, be recommended pass and re-referred to the General Register. Representative Loffer, welcome to the committee. Actually, what we're going to do is, as long as I believe that we've got some testifiers in the audience, we may as well start taking some of the testimony on the bill. And as soon as Representative Loeffler is here, my understanding, by the way, is she's not ditching it. She's just voting in another committee right now. So we've got Mr. Renner, Mr. Aarons, Mr. Straczynski, and Ms. Commit. If you all just want to kind of line up quick, and we'll go through the testimony, and away we go. Mr. Renner, welcome.
Chair members, thank you. My name is Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. Minnesota Medical Association represents over 10,000 physician, medical students, medical residents throughout the state. I will try to be brief so you can get some tip-off. We've been looking at health reform for many years. We are looking at market reforms. We think HSAs and high deductible plans are one option of that health reform, and we have been very supportive of those. We've also been looking at trying to ensure that we have our incentives lined up right in our healthcare system. And one of those incentives is rewards, incentives for both providers and for patients related to preventive services. I think we should be looking at public policy that aligns those incentives so that we can help people healthy and reward the avoid the much higher cost that comes from having to treat disease if we are unable to prevent disease. I think the policy question before you with this legislation is this legislation does not prohibit high deductible plans, nor does this prohibit high deductible plans that have cost sharing related to preventive services. What it does do is it says that if you want to get the tax advantages through HSAs or MSAs, those then would have to cover first dollar coverage for preventive services. We think that's a legitimate policy question. We think that's a legitimate approach that the state should pursue as we try to align those incentives and ensure that people receive the preventive services necessary to help reduce overall health care costs. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members of the Medical Association strongly supports this bill and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly here. I've got TiVo, so the game is going to be recorded anyway. But, Mr. Renner, I'm kind of surprised that you would support this in that HSAs are basically set up for people that want a tax deduction on their contribution to the plan, and this makes it so that there's first dollar coverage. But if you have enough money where you need a tax deduction, you have the money in there to pay first dollar coverage on everything. So why are you doing this?
Mr. Renner?
Mr. Chair and members, again, when our focus is on health system reform, we've been looking to ensure that we align incentives. And and very clearly the data shows that if you incentivize people to get preventive services, we will reduce overall costs. What we don't want is people who are starting up HSAs start making choices of saying, should I get that preventive service or should I put that off and keep that in my account and not get the services needed.
But Mr. Chairman and Mr. Renner, to that point, if you have an HSA, it means you have it because you want to save money on taxes. If you need to save money on taxes, you've probably got money to put in there. I mean, I this is what I do for a living. I can't imagine selling an HSA with a $10,000 deductible to somebody that doesn't have any money.
Mr. Renner?
Mr. Chair and members, I would hope that's the case. I can tell you we are seeing a greater amount of non-collectibles and accounts payable in healthcare systems. So the first time with the seeing of the economic downturn, we are seeing it is hitting healthcare, and it's mainly because we are seeing a greater number of high deductible plans, and people are now all of a sudden putting off healthcare because now they have higher deductibles. We don't think that's the appropriate incentive related to preventive services.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Renner, if you have an HSA, you have money.
Thank you, Representative David. Thank you,
You're
Mr.
Welcome.
Renner. Next up is Mr. Aaron. And to the extent you can avoid retreading the same ground, we'd appreciate it.
We'd be happy to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Ahrens, Director of Government License to the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. The American Cancer Society is the largest voluntary organization representing cancer patients, caregivers, survivors in the United States and in Minnesota. We support this bill for just a very simple reason. We hope and believe it will lead to prevention, more screening for cancer, and we'll hope it will reduce the kinds of choices consumers might make between saving money and getting prevention. We hope those choices don't happen. But what we do know is that prevention saves lives and saves costs. And I wanted just to share with you a couple facts. One is that if a woman has a mammogram, it's about $125. But if they don't get screened and they later find they have cancer, stage one breast cancer costs could cost between $22,000, and then later stage could be upwards around $60,000 in costs. So if a woman doesn't get screened, those costs really could go up if they need treatment later. We hope this bill leads to more prevention, saving costs, and saving lives. Colon cancer gets a little bit more steep. A colonoscopy is about $1,000 or $1,500. But in compare that to if there is no screening, someone finds that they have cancer later, costs could rise between 16 to treat low-stage colon cancer up to $200,000 to treat late-stage colon cancer. So again, if this bill leads to more prevention and more screening, we believe it will not only save and avoid cancer, but it could save healthcare costs that would be saved by consumers as well as insurance companies. We support this bill because we hope it leads to more prevention, and we don't want to see consumers trading off the values of adequacy of healthcare versus the affordability of healthcare. Mr. Chairman of the committee, we support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ahrens. I see Mr. Straczynski is on the list. Representative Loeffler has joined us. Is Mr. Straczynski here, by the way?
There's so many bills going on.
Yeah, there's so many. And we also have Ms. Kmit. But Representative Loeffler, if you want to, Mr. Renner actually did a great walkthrough of your bill in the course of his testimony. But if you'd like to give us a snippet, we'd be happy to hear it.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your patience. We're doing lots of roll calls up in 200, so it's an exciting day. I'll just say that this bill is about saving lives and reducing health care costs, and it's not about what high-deductible health plans can be offered on the market. It doesn't eliminate any of the current product offerings from the market. What it just says is if you're going to get the tax benefit of a health savings account, you should have preventative coverage, which is a federal option under the federal HSA legislation. So this is about the savings account. What kind of policy will earn the tax advantage of the savings account? These are very high deductible health plans, work for a lot of people. They're appropriate. Some employers offer significant contributions towards the deductible. Some don't offer any. There are already current requirements in federal law about what a high deductible health plan has to include in terms of maximum deductibles, maximum out of pocket. This would just add one more, saying that to get the tax benefit of the HSA, you would cover full prevention with no cost. The cost of prevention, right now, you can go on the web and you can put in little numbers and ages, and you can see that it's about $404 a month for someone to get a $300 prevention benefit. Let's say that you were up to a higher age and you'd even need $1,000 or $1,200 of prevention. That might mean an extra $12 a month. Compared to the life-saving benefit, I think that's a good trade-off I think most people will make. For price points, our insurance companies are very creative, and they could change a $2,850 deductible to $2,900, and I think most people would think that was a good trade-off for getting preventative care.
Thank you,
and with that, I'll respond to questions.
And we have Ms. Kmit, I believe, that was also signed up to testify. We lose the room, folks, in 4 minutes, so that's why I'm trying to make sure that folks get an opportunity to be heard as best they can. They're playing right here. Yeah, they're spelling out the Ms. Kmit. We made sure to lose our room at 6.
That was smart. Mr. Chair, with some of my committee, said that policy.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Let me make this really brief. What Representative Loeffler's bill will do is just put a requirement on HDHPs, high deductible health plans, that anytime that somebody has an HSA and they have an HDHP, that HDHP, that high deductible health plan, has to have preventive services. We had a conversation out in the hall just before this hearing, and health plans don't know if somebody has an HSA. Somebody comes to the health plan and buys a high deductible health plan. They're not going to know if there's an HSA that's paired with it. Likewise, the HSA company, the bank, doesn't know if somebody has an HDHP. That's part of what the consumer has to match up as part of having that arrangement. The effect of this legislation is that we can't maintain two systems. We can't maintain a system trying to figure out, well, we're going to sell an HDHP without preventive services with the hopes that somebody is not pairing it up with an HSA, because we're not going to know that. At the same time, so the net effect of this legislation is going to be that we're simply not going to sell HDHPs without preventive coverage for individuals. And that's just going to take one option off the table, and it's just going to be a little bit more expensive for anyone who wants to buy that option. So that's the net effect of this legislation. That's why we would oppose it.
Thank you, Ms. Kmit. Mr. Ickey, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Ickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. Wanted to make a few quick comments. We oppose the legislation because we just feel you need to keep as many options out there for people as possible. And taking this option away for people who are really price sensitive is going to lead to people being more underinsured or uninsured. And for the people who are affected by that, you know, that's sensitively affected by cost. My understanding is in the group market, if you're offering an HSA in the context of a group plan, the big three at least are offering some preventive care. They're the vast majority of the market, 90% plus, I believe. So for the most part, it's not that much of an issue in the group market, but it really is in the individual market for people who are extremely price sensitive. And I think you got to leave every option open to them. And then finally, I don't know if it was said tonight or not, because I just walked in, but our last hearing we talked about, you know, people who have neglected a health situation and had an unfortunate end. I mean, that can happen to anybody who's fully insured. Now, that requires the will of people to see doctors. Sometimes many require a lot of testing. So fully insured, partially insured, Cadillac insured, or really trying to save some money on HSA, that is really the will of the individual to look into their health situation and how many appointments they're willing to go to. And so that's not a reason to pass this bill, in our opinion, and I urge you not to advance it.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey.
Ms. Smith. One more thing. I just want to make very clear that I hope I didn't misspeak or leave the committee under the impression that an ACHP doesn't cover preventive services. They do. They just may not cover it at first dollar coverage.
Understood. Thank you for the clarification. Representative Ellers?
Mr. Chairman, just one question. Representative Loeffler, and I'll be brief. Mr. Chairman, the former chair sitting next to me who sells the products every day said that if we pass your bill, there'd be fewer products. You said there weren't.
Representative Loeffler?
I'm just trying. Yeah. Or more expensive. There would be fewer products on the market, and those that would be left would be more expensive.
Mr. Chair and Representative Diller, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think it's important to realize there's lots of choice in the market, because our Commerce Department approves 1,200 insurance plans every year. And these policies existed before the federal government offered the HSA option. So you will still be able to offer those. To get the tax advantage, which costs our state treasury about $9 million a year, you would have to get a policy that covers prevention fully. And like I say, I think you can reach the same price point for a consumer with a minor tweaking of the out-of-pocket cost. You could add a copay of $150 for an ambulance ride. There's lots of things when you're working on insurance products and pricing to make a price point.
Thank you. Chair will renew his motion that House File 705 be recommended to pass and referred to the committee. I'm sorry, to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Quick row. We really do, by the way, lose the rule in like 15 minutes, and I wanted to give him a chance to clean up.
The doesn't start until like 7:30.
Go for sure.
You're talking about that orange team, orange ball.
Actually, that's Representative Canoe. She picks all orange teams in the pool, apparently, but...
Why am I not surprised?
Tuesday and Thursday next week, the deadlines are going to be particularly heavy. We are doing our best to kind of sort out some issues with some of those bills so they move more rapidly, but I'd plan on a little bit later on Tuesday and possibly not quite as late on Thursday.
Mr. Chairman, for that false bill, that's going to take a while. That's really
Represent,
bad.
Which bill is that, Representative Davis? I'm not Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, I think we should thank the producer of the treats that we had to start the committee. Yeah. Those were outstanding. Thank you.
Yeah. You're here.
And I heard they were swell. I never actually got one. To our special assistants who have been running like crazy, keeping track of various engrossments, and they bake too, thank you all very, very much. We'll see you all on Tuesday. Have a good weekend. We're adjourned.
Hold over.